Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science. But first, let me make a short announcement, and that is I'll be on a book tour. I'm promoting a new book called The Future of Humanity. We're talking about perhaps a new era in space exploration. The question is, what about the pros and cons? How much will it cost? The dangers, the excitement? What about the future of humanity in outer space? So once again, the name of the book is The Future of Humanity, and I'll be speaking in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and maybe I'll be speaking at a city next to you. First of all, in New York City on February 19th, on Monday at 7 p.m., I'll be speaking at the Barnes & Noble on 82nd Street and Broadway. Once again, that's Monday, February 19th. I'll be at the Barnes & Noble right here in Manhattan. And then in March, I'll be in Berkeley. March 6th, I'll be speaking for KPFA Radio, a Pacifica affiliate. I'll be speaking at the First Congregational Church at 2345 Channing Way. And so once again, on February 19th, I'll be speaking in Manhattan at the Barnes & Noble in Upper West Side. On March 6th, I'll be speaking at the First Congregational Church at 2345 Channing Way. And if you want to find out more, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Well, in this segment of Exploration, I'd like to answer some of the emails that I've been getting, specifically emails concerning space exploration. Just last week, we had that rather sensational launching of the Falcon Heavy rocket, a moon rocket, the first moon rocket in 50 years to be launched from Cape Canaveral. And the question is, what does it mean? Does it mean that we're entering a new era of space exploration, or is it just deja vu all over again and it's going to peter out? So in this segment of Exploration, we'll try to answer some of the questions that I get concerning my book and also the future of space travel. Well, the first question I get in my emails is the launch of the Falcon Heavy. The media made a big thing about it, but was it really historic? I mean, wasn't it deja vu all over again? Well, first of all, there was a little bit of deja vu. I mean, after all, the rocket did not look like the space shuttle. It looked like the Apollo mission. That is, the compartment for the astronauts would be placed right on top of the missile, not to the side of the missile, as in the space shuttle. And power-wise, it was actually a little bit less than the power generated by the Saturn V. So yeah, in that sense, there was a little bit of deja vu. However, that's when it's all different. First of all, the Saturn rocket costs an enormous amount of money. In 1966, for example, at the height of the space race, it turned out that the NASA budget was 5% of the entire federal budget. And that was unsustainable. Just think about that. 5% of the entire U.S. federal budget went into NASA and the space race to the moon. Well, that was unsustainable. Well, how much did the Falcon Heavy cost the taxpayers? Well, get ready for a shock. Zero. Zero. It was funded by a private individual, Elon Musk of SpaceX and Tesla Motors. That's right. He did it on his private financing because, in some sense, we are entering a new era of the space age, an era that was set into motion by President Barack Obama, and that is private enterprise. Private enterprise coming in, trying to make a buck, but streamlining the process so that the energy and the initiative of private enterprise is harnessed to shoot rockets into outer space. So let's take a look at the fact that this is really a historic development. First of all, the price of space travel has been dropping rather dramatically. In the old days, only the United States and Russia could send things into orbit. Now, India and China can do it. In fact, India, just a few years ago, successfully sent a Mars probe, all the way to Mars, and did it on the first try. This is unheard of. That's how much the cost of space travel has dropped, that even developing nations like India can send packages all the way to Mars, not to mention that China. China has a vigorous space program. It's made it one of its priorities. The next goal of the Chinese space program is to create a space station that orbits the Earth, and then after that, to plant the Chinese flag on the moon. So China definitely has the moon in its sights. And so what it means is that even developing nations see the opportunity because of the fact that the price of rocketry has dropped, not to mention the fact that the Falcon Heavy, after launching its payload, a Tesla Roadster, into outer space, the booster rockets landed back on the planet Earth. Now, that is historic. We're talking about reusable rockets entering into the commercial marketplace. Now, think about the car. The car used to be rather expensive for the average Joe. After World War II, we had all these GIs that came back penniless from the war front wanting to buy a car. But cars were still out of the reach of the average GI. Then came the used car market. That changed everything. All of a sudden, the used car became part of the American lifestyle. Songs were written about used cars. In fact, today, more used cars are sold than new cars. That's how big the used car market is, which has driven down the cost of transportation. Well, the same thing happening here. If I take a rocket, where does most of the energy go into? Well, you may say to yourself that most of the energy of a rocket goes into the payload. Wrong. Nope, not the payload at all. Most of the energy of a rocket goes into sending its own rocket fuel into outer space. Now, what a waste. Think about that. Most of the energy of a rocket goes into sending itself, that is, its rocket fuel, into outer space. Therefore, why not reuse the booster rocket? And that's what the Falcon Heavy was all about, a reusable rocket to drive down the cost of space travel. So how expensive is space travel? It costs about $10,000 to put a pound of anything into near-Earth orbit. $10,000 a pound. That's your weight in gold. Think about that. Your weight in gold to put you in orbit. Forget the moon, forget Mars. To put you on the moon would cost about $100,000 a pound. To put you on Mars would cost about $1 million a pound. So think of your body made out of diamonds, and you begin to understand how costly space travel is and why historically only the great powers had access to outer space. Now prices are dropping. According to Elon Musk's SpaceX, they're shooting for 10% of the original cost. They want to get it down to about $1,000 a pound to put you into outer space. And the economics could change completely. Now, what else? This is not deja vu all over again. This is a whole new vision emerging from the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who are helping to foot the bill so that the taxpayers don't have to shoulder the burden. Their vision is as follows. Elon Musk's vision is to create a multi-planet species so that we're not stuck just on one planet Earth in case something happens to the Earth. And for Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, his vision is to create the Earth into a park, so that the heavy industries would be put into outer space, all the pollution would be off the planet Earth, the Earth itself would become a park. And then what about Amazon? Amazon would become a delivery system for the moon. That's right, the same efficiency that Amazon uses for deliveries on the planet Earth would then be used for deliveries to the moon. Now, Jeff Bezos of Amazon is just not talking into the wind. He's putting his money where his mouth is. He has funded a private spaceport. Now, think about this. Think of having your own private Cape Canaveral. Well, that's what Jeff Bezos has done. He's the richest man in the world. He has lots of money to blow, and he's created a spaceport. a spaceport in Texas with private money, not taxpayers' money, to shoot tourists into outer space. He's already dreamed of three varieties of rockets. One rocket, suborbital, simply to take passengers 70 miles straight up into outer space. Next would be rockets to go to the moon, and then after that, rockets to go to Mars, perhaps. And so we have visionaries coming from Silicon Valley who want to change the whole dynamic of the Cold War. Now, another question I get is, aren't some people getting ahead of themselves? I mean, look at all the problems on the planet Earth, like global warming. Are you saying that we should flee the Earth because of global warming? Is that the solution? Well, no, that's obviously not the solution. The solution to global warming is a political one, and that has to be waged on the planet Earth, not in outer space. Whether or not the Earth is engulfed with a toxic weather depends on the politics of the planet Earth, not the dynamics of sending something to Mars or beyond. Second of all, no one is saying that the entire population of the Earth is going to go into outer space. We're only talking about a settlement. That is an insurance policy. An insurance policy because one day life could really be threatened by natural and man-made sources. First of all, you have to realize that Mother Nature can be rather cruel. 99.9% of all life forms on the planet Earth have gone extinct. In other words, extinction is the norm. And why is extinction the norm? Because when the environmental conditions change, either you adapt, leave, or die. That's the law of nature. After all, what happened to the dinosaurs? The dinosaurs aren't here today to talk about it because, well, they didn't have a space program. There was no way for the dinosaurs to deflect or to flee, given the fact that an asteroid about 6 miles across was headed their way and plowed into the Yucatan of Mexico, creating a crater 180 miles in diameter, which sent up enough junk into outer space to blanket the sun so that the dinosaurs died. Now, again, no one is saying that this is going to save the Earth. No one is saying that we're going to have to leave the Earth with trillions of rocket ships in order to repopulate planets around the universe. No one is saying that. People are saying that we just need an insurance policy, a settlement on the distant planets. I once interviewed Carl Sagan right here on Exploration, and he explained it as follows. Carl Sagan told me that the Earth is in the middle of a shooting gallery, that we are surrounded by asteroids. Many of these asteroids will eventually hit the Earth, and perhaps some of them are big enough to cause an extinction event. So his point of view was we should become a two-planet species. That is, life is simply too precious to be placed on one planet, that we should place it at least on two planets, not because we're going to evacuate one because of global warming to repopulate another. No, just to create a settlement so that we have an insurance policy against man-made and natural disasters. And the man-made disasters, well, you're familiar with them. Global warming is real. It's not a fiction, and the solution will have to be a political one. Then we have the question of biogerms. Is it possible that a weaponized virus can escape from the laboratory and infect the population of the world? Well, you cannot rule that out. And then what about nuclear proliferation? That is also a possibility. Yet another possibility is a supervolcano, like what happened about 75,000 years ago. It's absolutely amazing to me that when you look around the room and you look at all these peoples of different colors and nationalities and languages, that we're almost all clones of each other. We are extremely closely related, so closely related that if you trace back our lineage, you can trace back our genetic heritage to one woman and one man about 100,000 years ago. In other words, there was some event that happened. Some event that happened 70 to 100,000 years ago that wiped out most Homo sapiens, and we are the survivors. We are the ones who made it. But most of our fellow human beings did not make it. But that's why we're almost clones of each other. So what event was so catastrophic that it killed most humans, and only a handful of us were left in Africa to repopulate the entire Earth? Amazing. Only a few hundred to a few thousand of us were left to repopulate the entire planet. What was that event? Well, we don't know. One theory is that 75,000 years ago, a volcano called the Toba volcano erupted. It was the most massive supervolcano eruption in for millions of years. And as a consequence of that, there was a darkening of the atmosphere around Indonesia and around Africa. And that probably is what killed off many of our ancestors. We don't know for sure, but then the question is, can it happen again? And the answer is yes, right in our own backyard. We have Yellowstone. Yellowstone National Park, we have Old Faithful. Many of us go there to take photographs of Old Faithful, but lurking underneath Old Faithful is a super volcano that could go off who knows when. Maybe tomorrow, maybe not for another 10,000 years. We really don't know that much about the super volcano that could wipe out life on the planet Earth. So that was a question that people ask me, and that is, what's new? What's new with this new launching of the Falcon Heavy? Well, another question I get asked is Mars. Isn't it far-fetched? Isn't it far away? Isn't it dangerous? Well, yes, all of the above, but technology is bringing Mars much closer than we realize. First of all, we're talking about private funding. We're talking about Elon Musk and SpaceX already. Already they have a new rocket that they are considering called the BFR. B for big, R for rocket, and you can guess what the F is for. The BFR is a rocket that'll take us to the planet Mars. And then, of course, the next question is, how dangerous is it? What would it be like to go to Mars? Well, first of all, it would take about a 2-year journey. Now, to go to the moon was a piece of cake. The moon is only 3 days away from us. You go there on Monday, you come back on Friday. And so the moon is only 3 days away. Mars is 9 months away, so a round trip to Mars would take about 2 years. That's with rockets that we have today. With other kinds of rockets, like ion rockets, some people would think we can squeeze it down to a few months. But with the rockets of today, we're talking about a round trip to Mars taking about 2 years. What do we have to worry about? We have to worry about weightlessness. What are we going to eat when we get to Mars? What about energy? How are we going to live? Well, let's take these things one at a time. First of all, how are we going to live on Mars cheaply? Well, the first thing we can do is to explore lava tubes. Lava tubes exist naturally, left over from ancient volcanoes, and they are ready-made, just ready to be walked in. And that could provide shelter from radiation, micrometeorites, dust storms, a ready-made habitat called lava tubes on the surface of Mars. And then next, what about fuel and what about water and what about air to drink? Well, Mars actually has plenty of ice. It is a frozen desert, and because it's a frozen desert, the water can be melted. And with the melting of water, we can create, first of all, oxygen for breathing. We can create liquid water for drinking and hydrogen. The hydrogen locked in water could be used as rocket fuel. And so, in other words, the first thing our astronauts would want to do is, well, of course, display your solar panels to get energy. But the energy of our solar panels would be used to process ice. By mining ice, we could extract out oxygen, liquid water for drinking purposes, and hydrogen for rocket fuel. And then third, to make it self-sustaining, you would have to terraform Mars. Now, this, of course, gets us into science fiction, but the first step would be to use genetic engineering to create algae that can thrive in the Martian atmosphere. algae that can withstand cold temperatures, that love carbon dioxide, algae and superplants that would thrive in the Martian atmosphere to create a Martian agriculture. That is a definite possibility. And then the last possibility is to send up solar satellites to gradually melt the polar ice caps. Now, this, of course, is science fiction, but is within the realm of possibility perhaps in a century or so. And that is launch satellites that have solar panels on them. The solar panels direct sunlight onto the polar ice caps, and the polar ice caps begin to melt so that liquid water flows freely on the surface of Mars for the first time in 3 billion years. Now, Elon Musk, the visionary, has his own ideas for terraforming Mars. He's toyed with the idea of using nuclear weapons to be detonated on the ice caps, and that would be the energy source that melts the ice caps. Well, personally, I think that could, well, maybe not a good idea. After all, we're not sure about the stability of the ice caps. Would you drink water that's radioactive? We don't know what that would do by detonating hydrogen bombs on the ice caps. But his sentiment is correct, and that is there's plenty of water on Mars. There's water in the permafrost, in the tundra, underground, right under your feet. And there's water on the polar ice caps, water that could be melted and then used for drinking purposes, for oxygen, and then for rocket fuel as well. And then the question is, well, who's going to pay for all these things? I mean, these things are not going to be cheap, even with usable rockets. Things are going to be expensive. Well, this is where, once again, private funding comes in. Google has already stated that they've set up a company called Planetary Resources to look into the question of mining the asteroids. It turns out that the asteroids have many valuable minerals that are rare on the planet Earth. These are called rare earths. They're used in Silicon Valley, and they are precious, and China has a near monopoly on them. And the Chinese, just a few years ago, exercised that monopoly and sent shivers right through Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley realized that they are wholly dependent on the Chinese for rare earths to keep Silicon Valley going. Well, it turns out these asteroids have plenty of rare earths on them, also platinum-like metals that are quite valuable. And if you could rope one of these asteroids, bring them down to Earth, you could mine them for tens of billions of dollars. Now, of course, you'd have to do this very carefully. NASA originally had what is called the Asteroid Direct Program. The Asteroid Direct Program was precisely that: to send the SLS booster rocket into outer space, land on an asteroid, rope it, and then slowly bring it down to the planet Earth. Doesn't sound like science fiction, because NASA has looked at the dynamics of and the economics of this mission. However, it was cut because the priority is now to go to the moon and to go to Mars. But again, Silicon Valley billionaires from Google are seriously looking at the possibility of mining the asteroids. Because after all, look at the gold rush. The gold rush in California took this wasteland that Thomas Jefferson thought would take 1,000 years to colonize and jump-started the development of the West within a matter of a few decades. So the very existence of California and Western United States was due to the gold rush. Well, why not have a gold rush in outer space? Well, then the last question says, what about going to the stars? The planets are nice, but what about the stars? I mean, after all, scientists have discovered about 4,000 planets going around other stars in our sector of the galaxy. There could be billions of Earth-like planets in outer space, and maybe, just maybe, there are aliens out there who also have an advanced technology. Maybe one day we'll bump into them. So the question is that a good idea? Are they going to be peaceful? Are they going to be evil? What about aliens in outer space as we go to the stars? Well, my personal point of view is that perhaps aliens that exist in outer space are going to be peaceful for the most part. They're going to be thousands of years more advanced than us if they have starships and can regularly go across the stars. So they'll be peaceful for the most part. And to plunder the Earth, not necessary. They can plunder uninhabited planets out there with plenty of minerals and resources. They don't have to plunder the Earth. But, that said, but there's always the small possibility that everything I've said is wrong. For example, if you are a deer in the forest and you meet a developer, well, the developer may be neutral concerning deers. However, he just wants to do one thing, pave the entire forest, independent of how many creatures are destroyed because their habitat is annihilated. So in other words, even in the novel War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, the Martians didn't hate Earthlings. They didn't come to the Earth to torture us and murder us. No, we were just in the way. And that's why the Martians came to the Earth to push us out. And so, in other words, we have to worry not just about evil aliens who may want to enslave us and torture us. We also have to worry about, well, aliens that are so advanced that we simply get in the way. Well, you may say to yourself, well, why don't we talk to them and tell them that we're worth saving? Well, if you go to the forest, do you talk to the deer? Do you talk to the squirrels? Well, maybe initially. But eventually, you kind of lose interest because, well, the deer and the squirrels don't talk back to you, and they certainly don't talk to you about anything interesting. And so, for the most part, you ignore them. Or, if you walk down a country road and see an anthill, do you go down to the ants and say, I bring you trinkets, I bring you beads, I give you nuclear energy, take me to your ant queen, or perhaps you have this politically incorrect urge to step on a few of them. So my personal point of view is, as we go into outer space, we should not advertise our existence, especially because we don't know what the intentions are of other alien species in the universe. We should, for the most part, keep our identity secret. Now, you may say to yourself, don't we have television? Don't we have radio? Aren't we broadcasting our presence into outer space? Well, yeah, but maybe the aliens aren't listening to our frequencies. Or maybe they simply got bored watching I Love Lucy and Leave It to Beaver. So for the most part, they'll either ignore us or leave us alone. I think that's probably the best way to encounter an intelligent civilization that could be centuries, millennia more advanced than ours. Well, that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, inviting you to stay for the second half of Exploration. When we talk to an astronaut, we talk to astronaut Tom Jones about what it's like to leave the planet Earth. And for that matter, what is it like to go on to the moon and perhaps even Mars? And so once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about astronauts who are brave enough to explore the universe. What does it look like in outer space? How will we live? How will we function in weightlessness, with radiation, with all sorts of hazards from outer space? So once again, with us today to talk about all these problems is astronaut Tom Jones from NASA. Stay tuned. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about, well, a new era in the space program. I have a new book coming out called The Future of Humanity, and I'll be on a book tour traveling around the country. I'll be speaking in New York City on February 19th, Monday, at the Barnes & Noble in Upper West Side on 82nd Street and Broadway at 7 o'clock. So once again, at the Barnes & Noble on February 19th. And then I'll be going on to Berkeley to speak in the Bay Area for KPFA Radio. That's right, our sister station, KPFA Radio. And that'll be on March 6th at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley at 2345 Channing Way. And I'll be speaking about the future of humanity. That is, the future of the space program, the pros, the cons, the visions, the dangers of the exploration of outer space. That was then covered in the first half of Exploration.
And then in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on our second guest, and we're going to go into outer space with astronaut Tom Jones, who spent 52 days in outer space, and he's written a semi-autobiographical book called Skywalking. So once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to go into outer space and talk about the past, the present, and the future of the space program. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Dr. Tom Jones. He's a former astronaut, author of the new book called Skywalking, An Astronaut's Memoirs. So we'll talk not just about the training of an astronaut, not just what it's like to go up there and out of space, but what about the future of the space program? Is it worth it? How dangerous it is? What about robotic missions, which are cheaper and safer? All these questions we will ask our special guest, Dr. Tom Jones, former astronaut and author of the new book, Skywalking, An Astronaut's Memoirs. The first question for you, Dr. Jones, is, as a youth, how did you first get interested in exploration and the space program?
It's easy to remember for me. My grandmother was a big reader, and so she went down to the five and dime store and bought on the remnant table a book called Space Flight, The Coming Exploration of the Universe. It was one of these little golden books of knowledge that you could get back in the 1960s. And so I was five, and she gave me this book, and it was filled with wonderful illustrations, paintings of what space flight might be like. There were no photos because no one had gone into space yet. But that really captured my imagination. These astronauts and spaceships were fascinating subjects to me, so I began to read more about those on trips to the library, and very quickly got fascinated with the subject of space science and astronomy. When I was 12, my parents got our family our first telescope, and I became the sole operator of it. it was tough to get other people to let other people use it, but I had it out a lot in suburban Baltimore. And along with the fact that they were building rockets in my hometown as part of the Gemini program in the middle 60s, I think all of these things combined to make astronautics and astronomy a very favorite subject of mine, which I just devoured in school and at the library.
And you went to the United States Air Force Academy. Why'd you go there, and did you have in the back of your mind this career path that would take you into outer space?
Well, certainly by the age of 10, I was aware of the job of astronaut and the fact that it was a reality and that they were building rockets in my hometown. And I said, well, I'd like to ride a machine like that someday. And during the Apollo program, as we watched the first run-ups to the moon landings, I was aware that test pilots were the ones who were selected to be astronauts. So if I wanted to do the job, I certainly had to become a test pilot. And you've got to go through a military flight training program. And I chose the Air Force. So the Air Force Academy seemed to me the best place that was focused on flying in the country. And that's why I tried to enroll there. By the time I was in college, the moon landings were just finishing. And so it was very clear that I still wanted to do this. And I thought that was a great jump on the program. Getting into flight school, becoming an Air Force pilot, and then becoming a test pilot.
And I understand that you flew missions on B-52 bombers for the Strategic Air Command. Could you elaborate?
Well, after a year of pilot training after graduation, I got a basic science degree at the Air Force Academy. I knew I was going to be flying for a while and then try to get into test pilot school. So my first assignment after pilot training was to go to Strategic Air Command, which was an outfit that was involved in nuclear deterrence. And my mission as a B-52 crew member, a co-pilot, and then an aircraft commander, was to sit alert duty out at the base. About once every 3 weeks, I would live for an entire week out at the base, trying to make sure that the Russians would always fear a counterattack if they tried to do a surprise attack on the U.S. So we trained for the nuclear delivery mission, a doomsday mission. And it was quite a strange existence. Every third week, you'd be waiting for the horn to blow, signaling a Russian attack, and then you'd jump into your planes and taxi out as fast as you could and take off. That's what we trained for. And fortunately, nobody ever shot at me, and the Cold War wound down to its eventual conclusion. While I was doing that, though, NASA brought along the space shuttle and changed the rules on how you could become an astronaut.
Now, many people who watched the movie, Top Gun with Tom Cruise, have dreamed about dogfights out there in the wild blue yonder. However, you went for a PhD in planetary sciences. So how did that come about?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was in the Air Force and sitting alert duty, and I remember clearly being out there on the base during one of those weeks of duty and watching the miniseries Cosmos by Carl Sagan. And this was a man and a television production that really captured my imagination. And I said, here's a guy who's doing this for a career, the thing that I've loved to study and read about all these years. And now that NASA is looking for scientists and engineers, maybe I can become a space scientist, and maybe that would be an alternate path. I knew that test piloting would be a tough assignment to get. It was very competitive in the Air Force, and especially for bomber pilots who weren't widely needed at that time. So after watching Cosmos and reading some more books about that particular profession, I decided I'd go back to graduate school and see if I could become a practicing research scientist.
Now, a lot of people ask the question, if I want to become an astronaut, what do I do? Do I send a postcard to NASA saying, sign me up? What is the career path? What is the process by which somebody out there can realize a dream of going into outer space?
Well, it's easier today with the Internet. You can get on the Internet and read all about astronaut selection at NASA.gov, NASA.gov, their website, and search for astronaut selection. But back then, you just wrote a letter to the Johnson Space Center in Houston where the astronauts train, and I got a reply back from the selection office, and they informed me about the basic qualifications. You have to send in an application, which includes a big civil service exam and a lot of paperwork to fill out, as well as a medical exam. And you just send in that application, they keep it on file, and then every time that they select a new group of astronauts, they'll notify you to see whether you're still interested in applying. And so I started that process in 1986.
Now, 1986 was also a watershed year because that's when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on international television, a very sobering event. Seven astronauts tragically lost their lives in that accident. And we sometimes forget that going into outer space is not a Sunday picnic, that about 1% of the time there is booster rocket failure and major malfunction of rockets. So was that sobering? How did that impact on you?
Oh, it was terrible. I was watching that accident. I was watching with the launch of that mission with Krista McAuliffe, the first school teacher to go into space, with a bunch of school students, elementary school students at the University of Arizona, where I was a graduate student. And the catastrophe unfolded before us on this big screen TV. And, you know, you had to try to make some sense of it for the kids and tell the kids that there was no hope that they'd gotten out. And it was a terrible emotional blow. Next door at the Lunar and Planetary Lab where I was studying, everyone was completely floored, devastated by this emotionally, even though most of the people were involved in planetary science and astronomy and robotic missions. They knew how serious this was for the future of space travel and exploration in general. So it was a real body blow. I had met the commander of that mission about a year before, and he'd encouraged me to apply to become an astronaut. He was a very motivated guy who was clear about his mission. And it was infectious. It motivated me to follow in his footsteps. And after his death, Dick Scobee, I decided that, well, he must have really believed in this to risk his life in such a way. And I knew that my desire to do it was very strong. And I thought if people like that I look up to are willing to risk their lives, then I still think I could find the courage to do the same thing. And I talked it over with my wife before I began applying.
Now, you're a former test pilot, and you know when you go into that cockpit that you're putting your life on the line. You know that unlike a civilian, which wants lots of life insurance and assurances, there's no problem. You know you're putting your life on the line when you go into a jet airplane. Now, when you become an astronaut, are the astronauts also told the same thing? We have civilians going into outer space. We have politicians and multimillionaires now going into outer space. Are they really mentally prepared for the fact that, well, like I mentioned, roughly 1% of the time there is catastrophic failure?
Well, we're certainly aware of the risks. As a pilot, I didn't become a test pilot. I actually left the Air Force after just flying bombers because I wanted to pursue the science path. But I knew that the professionals involved in flying the shuttle were aware of the risks. Of course, Scobie certainly was. And I decided that there must be a recognition among all the crew members that what they're doing must register on them as being so worthwhile that they're willing to risk their physical safety, even their lives, to accomplish these missions. And when I got into the Astronaut Corps in 1990, I found that to be true, that people were thinking of this as a long-term program of exploration. They figured that the benefits they'd bring back from each mission would be building blocks that future explorers would use to return to the moon, get to the asteroids and Mars. So we all viewed this as a continuum, and each little contribution that we made was worth the risk of our lives. Now, the shuttle's a pretty safe machine, even though it's had two terrible accidents. It's one of the most reliable rockets that's out there. So you can always tell yourself that it's not going to happen to you, but you must recognize that it's a finite possibility that each mission's got, you know, one in a couple of hundred chances of leading to a catastrophe.
Okay, now let's get into the guts of your book. That is the training of an astronaut and what it's like there to orbit the Earth and look down from outer space. First of all, the training. Let's talk about going into swimming pools, going into 1,000 horsepower centrifuges, going into the Vomit Comet. What is the grueling regimen that astronaut training entails?
Well, to begin with, it's much like a college curriculum of investigating the basics of spaceflight. So you bring in all these people who are test pilots and scientists and engineers, and they have varied backgrounds, but everyone's capable of learning. And so essentially it's a graduate course in spaceflight and its fundamentals and the systems that allow us to survive and work up there, the space shuttle in this case. So it's a year of astronaut basic training. And you start in a classroom, read a lot of books, get a lot of lectures. So that's very familiar to most of us. And yet, it moves very quickly into simulator training, where you're actually flipping switches, reading checklists, working as a team to put into practice what you've learned in the classroom. And there are also a lot of ancillary training experiences that are quite fun, even though they're very serious in mind, like survival training. What do you do if you bail out of a jet or out of the shuttle and you come down in some distant location where you've got to await rescue? So we had water and land survival training. We also, as you say, rode the centrifuge to prepare us for the accelerations of launch, scuba training to prepare us for underwater training in a spacesuit to simulate free fall, and finally that ride on the Vomit Comet that everybody looks forward to, where you get 20-second doses of free fall as the airplane rides this roller coaster path through the sky. And that's both exuberant and exhilarating, and then finally in the end it's an endurance contest to see if you can keep your stomach and your mind together while this airplane does these gyrations. But it's great to experience free fall.
Now, people who saw the movie Apollo 13 saw Tom Hanks floating for what seemed like forever. And people said, well, how'd they do that? There's no room for wires in that tiny little capsule. How'd they get Tom Hanks to float like that? And as you mentioned, it was this airplane called the Vomit Comet. And there's a reason for that. People throw up. Is that right?
Well, some do. Most people get a little queasy after the end of an hour and a half on that plane, where you do 40 up and down roller coaster cycles to give you those cycles of weightlessness that last 20 or 25 seconds. It's very aggravating to be in free fall for 25 seconds and then be slammed to the floor with two times the force of gravity as you pull out. And when you do that over and over, it tends to tumble your gyros and lead to nausea. I found that I never really got aggressively sick up there, but I certainly felt after the end of those 40 parabolas that I was ready to walk wobbly off the airplane and go sit down quietly for a while.
And let's talk about weightlessness. Weightlessness is the state of free fall. That is, if you're in an elevator and someone cuts the wire of the elevator, God forbid, you are in free fall and you are weightless because the floor of the elevator falls at the same rate that you do, giving you the illusion that there's no gravity. Of course, there's gravity. It's pulling you to the floor, but the floor is falling at the same rate as you. Same thing with the Vomit Comet. You're essentially being hurled like a rock into the atmosphere, and you are in free fall. So the question is, if you're in free fall, that sensation is a sensation of dying. That is, you're falling off a skyscraper. So is that the sensation that you have, that you're thrown like a rock into the atmosphere in the Vomit Comet? Is a sensation like the sensation that you're dying?
Well, fortunately, your body is pretty easily fooled. Your mind is fooled because you're in a cabin of an aircraft or you're in the cabin of a space shuttle, and you can't tell that you're being hurtled through the atmosphere or around the planet at hundreds or thousands of miles per hour as you fall, either on this roller coaster parabola or, you know, in an orbit around the Earth. So to you, your surroundings are falling with you. They all appear motionless. That's your frame of reference. And so you just appear to be floating. And so it's rather a gentle feeling. You don't feel any motion of high speed or even standing on the edge of a precipice and leaping off. So it's pretty easy to get used to. It's just a gentle lifting or a floating feeling, and it's nice to be able to move with just a fingertip push against the walls. And I find it's something that you actually forget about after a couple of days.
Now, you spent 52 days in Earth orbit during the 11 years you were in the astronaut program. So everyone wants to know, if you're up there for not just 20 seconds, but for days on end, how do you do very simple bodily functions? Like, for example, eating. How do you eat when your food floats in front of you? How do you drink if water will simply float to the ceiling? And what the question everyone wants to know is, how do you go to the bathroom?
Well, all of those subjects I try to explore in skywalking to give you that personal experience of being in there. The eating, fortunately, is almost a non-issue. All of your swallowing and digestive functions seem to work just fine with the peristalsis that moves things through your digestive tract at work. Doesn't need gravity to function. You do have to eat these foods out of a pouch and drink liquids from a pouch with a straw inserted so that food and debris and globules of liquid don't float around the cabin and mess up the systems up there. So it's rather tedious after a while that you have to eat one package at a time. You don't get to sample three or four dishes at once. You've got to eat in a serial fashion, and it almost becomes perfunctory after a week of the novelty wearing off. So, but it's aside from a little bit of extra time and care required, it's actually quite easy to eat and drink. And I still enjoy the varied menu that we had available to us. Even though the foods aren't fresh, they're at least freeze-dried or irradiated or thermostabilized, so they retain some good flavors. Now, the bathroom question, down here on the ground, gravity makes everything go where it's supposed to. And as I write in the pages of Skywalking, up there, you've got some special training to use because we use air instead of gravity to make things go where they're supposed to. Liquid down a suction hose where each crew member uses a personal funnel to guide the liquid into the tube. And for solid waste, it's blown into a storage tank underneath the commode seat. And then the clever thing about it is that the solid waste tank, while it's not in use, is exposed to a vacuum. So the solid waste is sterilized and dehydrated. So the next time it's used, there's no odor or chance of a pathogen getting back into the cabin. It's quite clever. And while it takes longer to use the system than on Earth, it actually functions quite well.
Well, according to the book, The Right Stuff, by Tom Wolfe, when our first astronaut, Alan Shepard, was sent into a suborbital trajectory, he had to go to the bathroom. He told Mission Control he had to go to the bathroom, and Mission Control vetoed it. And so they sent him into outer space, where he essentially urinated in outer space. Now, that is not a good thing to do, right? Because if you have liquid inside your spacesuit and you are weightless, it could be a mess, right?
Well, it certainly was a mess, and I'm sure he was quite a smelly guy when he came back and got out of the suit. But he survived just fine, and that's because of spacesuit design. They don't put any electronics generally inside an oxygen-filled suit unless there be an ignition source that could lead to a fire. So the inside of a spacesuit tends to be a quite benign place, and the liquid was just a little bit of mess. Fortunately, on the space shuttle, we deal with free fall inside a spacesuit by using diapers, large, absorbent, adult-sized diapers that can take care of that eventuality. And, you know, the space shuttle itself, you know, provides a means to get out of the suit right after you arrive in orbit, and you don't have to put the suit back on until reentry. So then you can use the bathroom facilities that we just discussed. So we're a long way from the right stuff now, and people seem to be able to deal with this quite easily.
Okay. Now, what is it like spiritually and emotionally to be in orbit, to look down on the planet Earth as you are in a spacewalk? suspended, orbiting the Earth, suspended in mid-flight with this little cable that connects you to the mother craft. What is it like to look back at the Earth?
Well, Michio, this was a great experience. I had been dreaming about spaceflight since I was 10. And here I was, 39 years old, on my first mission. And as I write in Skywalking, I got to orbit. I was so busy with my initial jobs that it was about an hour before I actually had a moment to look out the window. And I'll never forget that first impression of the Earth. I was looking out on the night side of Earth, and instead of stars, I saw this big round space or gap where stars should have been. That was the dark side of our planet. But on the very edge, the limb of the Earth, was a gentle band of robin's egg blue light that was growing in intensity and widening along the horizon of the Earth, and that was the coming sunrise. And this beautiful, delicate blue, and the fact that I was finally looking back at my planet after waiting for almost three decades to get there, brought tears to my eyes with the realization that I had finally arrived at that moment in time and space. And, you know, they were tears of gratitude to God for sending me up there and giving me the chance to do this, and they were just tears of appreciation at the beauty that I was seeing. And throughout my experiences in space on those rest of the other three missions I flew, the view of the Earth never became boring, or I never became blasé about it. It was always riveting. I had to tear myself away from the windows to go to work because it's always such a lovely sight and so attractive to a human being to gaze on our own world.
And do you also get a sense of the fragility of life? First of all, the atmosphere is extremely thin, and yet it's like the skin of an apple, and yet it creates life on the planet Earth, not to mention the fact that the Earth is suspended in this rather hostile environment of cosmic rays and potential meteor impacts. So do you get a feeling of the fragility of humanity, that we are, quote-unquote, on spaceship Earth?
You certainly get a sense that the Earth is a varied and delicate place. You see immense variety in color and in texture as you travel around the planet once every 90 minutes. Looking at the Earth's horizon, you can see this thin blanket of the atmosphere. You can look down at night and watch meteors burning up in it below you, and you can see the air glow layer high in the atmosphere against the dark night full of stars. So it's aesthetically beautiful, and you're aware of how thin that envelope of air is in particular. I found that you wanted to get to these thousands of places on Earth that you could see, that the rainforest, the glaciers, the high mountain peaks, the river valleys. You wanted to go personally to all of these places to learn more about the planet, and yet you realize as a human being you're never going to live long enough to go to all of these places that you've seen from orbit. I felt a great attraction and sense of longing in my heart to be part of Earth, and I felt separated from it to some extent, especially thinking that I was half a world away from my family most of the time. But generally, I had this great attraction for this lovely planet of ours, and I can't imagine what the Apollo astronauts must have experienced traveling 1,000 miles farther away in space than I did. And it was so strong for me, I'm sure that they must have had a great longing to get back.
Okay, now let's talk about the downside of being in outer space. For example, the Russians set the world's record for being in outer space on one mission, being lofted into space for over a year. And when that cosmonaut came back down to Earth, he could barely crawl. He was almost like a worm. The atrophy of the muscles was so great that he could not stand up. And so let's talk about the fact that when you're in space, you have enormous muscle and bone loss.
Short-term space flight doesn't present many problems. We exercised every couple of days while we were in space. The longest trip I had was 18 days. And so if you do a medium amount of exercise for an hour every other day, you're going to keep your heart, lungs, and muscles in good enough shape to do any physical task that's required and also to withstand reentry. And then you can sort of stagger off the space shuttle and get your land legs under you just as you were coming back from a long sea voyage. And within about a half an hour, you can walk under your own steam with no great worries. You feel heavy at first when you come back to Earth. That passes in about an hour. The longest effect that I felt was about 3 days of lacking a fine sense of motor balance. So I couldn't bend over from the waist and pick up a penny on the floor. That would have just toppled me over. I had to wait until my brain became used to using those inner ear balance organs again, and it took about 3 days for those to come back online. Now, for space station astronauts, like my friend Bill MacArthur, who's headed back to Earth on April 8th here, he's been up there for more than 6 months, and he's been exercising every day for 90 minutes. He's been using both a treadmill and an exercise bike and a resistive exercise device that allows him to do the equivalent of lifting weights up there. And by combining those forms of exercise, his muscle and cardiac health will be in pretty good shape when he comes home. So I think he'll be able to walk within about an hour. He's got the benefit of a lot of experience since that Russian mission 16 or 17 years ago. He'll be able to be more mobile when he comes back. He will have, however, some loss of calcium from his skeleton. He's lost some bone mass. Some of that will recover back on Earth. He'll probably have a permanent deficit of a few percent. And, of course, we don't know the long-term repercussions of that. So while he's going to get some professional physical rehabilitation, I think he'll have no short-term ill effects, and it'll only be in the later decades of his life that he finds out whether he's got skeletal weakening that's of any consequence. It doesn't appear to be a long-term effect for these six-month space station missions. But as you understand, Mars missions are an open question.
Okay, and now let's talk about the future, because you mentioned the Mars mission. The President of the United States has stated that we want to go to the moon and planet Mars, and the current director of NASA even startled quite a few people by saying in very blunt language that in some sense the space shuttle and the International Space Stations were not the way to go. Because the space mission basically stalled for several decades with a space shuttle and an International Space Station, and scientists are still scratching their heads trying to figure out how to extract any science out of the International Space Station. So let's talk about the Moon and Mars. First of all, the length of the mission to Mars. As we mentioned, it could be a year, 2 years in weightlessness, and doesn't that pose a problem if you go to Mars and you can't walk?
Certainly would be a problem. I think engineers now are trying to figure out a way to make the trip as short as possible with better propulsion. So it might be only 6 months each way in free fall. And we understand, I think, how to keep someone healthy enough to function when they get to Mars based on our space station experience. It could obviously be taken care of by adding a rotating segment of the spacecraft, a centrifuge that would allow you to work in a semblance of gravity on the way there. That's just an engineering penalty of weight and cost that you'll have to pay if you choose to go that route. The big open question is whether or not you can experience free fall for 6 months and then function in one-third G on Mars for a year and a half before you begin your return journey. Will that be sufficient to keep your body in good health? We can answer some of those questions on the space station with the centrifuge experiment, spinning lab rats at those lower G accelerations and combining that with free fall and see how they fare. So we'll gain some medical and operational experience on the space station before we set out. I personally think that humans can endure physically the free fall and low G combination. I think there's a lot of resilience in the human system, but we'll certainly have to do everything we can, both medically and with exercise, to prevent any deterioration on the way there.
Well, unfortunately, that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want more information about my book tour, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And it gives you all the cities that I'll be traveling in, signing copies of my latest book, The Future of Humanity. Once again, go to my website, mkaku.org, to find out all about my new book, The Future of Humanity. Good day.